Now, on Tuesday and Wednesday this week, we heard from two women who've experienced the knock. That's what they call it when they're told out of the blue that a loved one is being arrested for sexual offences against children. A woman we're calling Anne told our reporter Jo Morris about how her life fell apart because of her husband's crime. After many years of a happy marriage, she had to reassess everything, and all the while feeling afraid of the judgment of others online and in real life.
The whole world was getting to know about this before I'd even had a chance to even understand it myself. And they'd all decided that he was guilty. It's something I don't think anybody should have to go through. And then they all seemed to work together to make sure it spreads far and wide.
What sort of things were they saying about you?
To be honest, a lot of it I've just like numbed out. People saying that I must have known. That was the one that hurt me the most, that people thought I knew that and that I was going along with it. And I didn't know because I love children. And actually, I would say that's one of the things that really impacted me very hard was I felt guilty even looking at children after that. It was a really weird thing. I've got godchildren with their own children, and I felt I didn't want to be around them. I didn't feel I could touch them because I felt like I was as guilty as he was, even though I had nothing to do with any of it. It's a horrible thing that you're left with, that scar, and you think everybody's looking at you and judging. And yeah, it took me a long time to get over that, to be honest, to actually hold another child and have them on my knee.
And then on Wednesday, we heard how another woman we're calling Evie had to come to terms with the fact that her brother is a sex offender. She too is worried about the judgment of others, especially because she decided to continue to support him. That decision cost her dearly, as you'll hear in this clip, which has been voiced by an actor.
I think that for him, one of the triggers was intense loneliness and depression. So if I'm supporting him to be less lonely and less depressed, then I'm reducing the risk of him reoffending. It's just so taboo to say, I still love him. For some people, it's easier to just cut off all connections, and I totally get that. I feel like whatever decision somebody makes, it's really important to respect that and to appreciate that there's no easy decision. You can't say to anybody, I'm really upset because my brother's a sex offender, but I still love him. Yeah. I remember once, I felt really upset and I felt like I wanted to speak to somebody, and I was tempted to phone the Samaritans, but I didn't phone them because I felt like it would take away from the real victims. Like that was a support service for real victims, not me. So I felt like I didn't deserve it.
Evie there, not her real name, and you can hear both of those very powerful interviews in full on BBC Sounds. The programmes were on the 12th and 13th of September. Well, the Lucy Faithfull Foundation are a child sexual abuse prevention helpline and campaign, and I'm joined by their CEO, Deborah Dennis, and also by Rachel Armitage, Professor of Criminology at the University of Huddersfield. Welcome to both of you. As I just said, very powerful interviews. We got a huge response from our listeners, actually, and I will read some of those out. But Rachel, first to you, what struck you from what you heard from those two women?
Yeah, so thank you for having me on today, and thank you for talking about this subject today. And I also wanted to say thanks to Anne and Evie for sharing those stories, which are absolutely heartbreaking and reflect the hundreds and hundreds of stories that I hear every week, and Deborah hears as well. So loads of things struck me. I could talk for ages about it, but a couple of things from those clips that really struck me was the first one, really, both Anne and Evie sort of having an apprehension or apologising for bringing their own situation to the attention of yourself and society, really. And just constantly saying that they're not the real victim. You know, I didn't call Samaritans because I don't want to take away from the real victim. The children in the images are the real victims. So both, you know, gave this message right through. And I think another one that's really important that I would really like people to realize is that these two people reflect a lot of other people in this situation in saying and constantly reiterating that they didn't know. and feeling the need to say that and to clarify that. I think you've heard both saying, I racked my brains to think if I'd missed something, I'm not a stupid woman. People saying I must have known, and I think Anne said I must have, I didn't know, but I love children, and that she felt the need to say that over again is just, it's really, really sad. And it's a constant message that we hear.
Mm. Deborah, I tell you what stood out for me, Deborah, was when we heard her say she felt as guilty as he was.
Yeah, that's certainly something that we hear quite frequently from women, actually.
What's that about?
Well, part of this is around the perceptions, actually, of non-offending family members. When something like this happens, the society view and the shame and the stigma is so powerfully felt by these women that they look back thinking they must have done something wrong, or they look back thinking, where could I have seen this behavior? How could I have intervened? And the reality is that they weren't complicit, yet they feel like they were. They feel like society puts on them that they have been complicit. So we need to move from an environment in a society where that complicity is shifted into, actually, these are secondary victims themselves. The trauma that they're going through is very, very real. What happens at the first stage of the knock doesn't go away. The impact continues months, years. We hear these stories from hundreds of women, thousands, 1,000 women call our helpline every year talking about the impact that they've had. And some of that is, what could I have done? And the answer is, it's not a woman's job to police their husband or their brother or their father or whoever it is that has committed the offences. And they shouldn't feel that way. But society almost perpetuates it for them, sadly.
Do they feel guilty for not knowing?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Go on.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll get you both. You're both agreeing. Let's hear from you, Rachel.
Yeah, I'd say absolutely they do, and I think that's something that people are made to feel as well. Sometimes by agencies, by family, by friends. You know, you should have spotted the signs. What, you know, is that something that you let him down in terms of your sexual relationship, etc.? So I think it isn't just a feeling. This is actually a reality that people almost make families feel this.
Deborah.
Yeah, well, I'd agree. We have a family and friends forum. 40,000 people visit that every year. 2,000 are posting, supporting each other. And that is one of the key themes that we see them talking about, actually, is should I have known? What could I have done? And what's great about the forum is people can jump in and say, well, actually, I've been through this and I've looked back and I can't identify a point anywhere where I could have known or intervened. And actually, it's not your job to. So there's sort of peer support going on to help people think that through.
So is that why you are saying they should be recognised as secondary victims, because of the huge stigma that they're having to deal with and the societal judgment?
Absolutely. We need to shift that approach from this idea that in some way family members have been complicit into a place of, actually, these are secondary victims also. And the tragic fact is that given the scale of online offending, given the scale that police are arresting 900 people a month, it's almost inevitable that at some point soon, all of us will know somebody who has been affected in this way. It's almost inevitable that the scale is that big that it's going to happen to us all. At some point, we will know somebody, and we need society to catch up and make it okay to talk about, make it okay for women to get help, make it okay for them.
Just because you've just dropped a figure there that I think is quite shocking, you get 900 calls a month.
No, sorry, 900 arrests. So police figures will show that we have 900 people being arrested each month. And that's young people.
And it's getting to the point where we will all know somebody, because I think this is one of those crimes where it happens over there.
Over there. Mm-hmm. And of course, we'd love to believe that. Child sexual abuse is abhorrent. And we would love to believe that it happens to somebody else and it's not going to be involved in our circle or our family or our friends' network. But the reality is there are 900 people being arrested a month, and that is the tip of the iceberg. So inevitably, at some point, we will become touched by this issue.
Can I
yes,
come
Rachel,
in
please
there,
do.
There,
yeah.
Yes. So in terms of that number, it's quite difficult to get the statistics, but we've done some work on this. And of that 900, you know, to 1,000 a month, we've estimated that about 35 to 40% of those will have children living at the home at the time of the knock or the warrant. So basically, that's 10 families with children a day going through this. And Anne said something in one of the clips saying that there'll be a family being destroyed by this every day, but actually, you know, we're looking at about 10 with children. So that's just those families with children, many more where there aren't children living at the home. But really, the repercussions are unbelievable in that situation.
And we've talked a lot about men, and you mentioned young men being arrested as well, Deborah. But what, are women ever arrested for these crimes?
It's not unheard of, but it is absolutely the minority. So if we look at our helpline data from people who are concerned about their own thoughts and behaviour towards children, including those who have offended online, 98% are male. We do get calls from females, and we do, through our assessments and interventions work, assess females who have engaged in behaviour. But it is without doubt the minority.
And Rachel, you're talking about the research that you've done there for the Lucy Faithfull Foundation. Tell us a bit more about that. What did you find? Were there high levels of post-traumatic stress?
Yeah. So basically, Deborah and her team commissioned this research, which actually was originally to look at the forum that Deborah mentioned. And it's a friends and family forum where people can make comments and support each other. And really, it was about looking at whether or not that was helping and how it was helping. But as part of that, it became much clearer that we needed to talk about the harms that these families were experiencing. So it kind of went off at a tangent really there, and absolutely one of the key findings, as you've alluded to there, was of our survey of 126 family members, we found that 70% of those had symptoms that would be indicative of post-traumatic stress, and 65% so severe, that PTSD, that it would be impacting their immune system functioning. So hair loss, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, and that was just one of the findings from it. And just to say that really relates to the knock itself.
Yeah, the actual knock on the door.
And the hypervigilance and the humiliation and the how that impacts people going forward of remembering and flashing back to that moment.
And what happens at that point? So you get the knock at the door, the children might be in.
It will be in. It will be in, yeah.
What support is in place? What happens next?
So, yeah, just to clarify, you know, one of the policies is that if children live at the address, the knock will happen between 6 and 8 a.m. when the children are in as a safeguarding measure. In terms of, I mean, the two ladies who gave, wonderful interviews hadn't been signposted to any charity, and they're left in isolation. And this is traditionally how it has been. But I would like to say that, you know, we are getting better now, and police forces, we've been doing training to encourage them to do the knock more sympathetically and to make sure that they automatically refer families to support agencies, of which there are now, and obviously weren't when Anne and Evie went through what they went through. But there's we set up a charity called Talking Forward, and there are police forces now that will take the name of the family and give that to Talking Forward, who will ring within 48 hours and ensure that that family feels supported, and invite them to peer support. There's some wonderful work going on in Thames Valley with a charity called Family Matters that act as an advocacy for families right from the knock through the criminal justice system. Another police force, Lincolnshire Police Force, have employed the equivalent of a family liaison officer, so an indirect victim support officer who holds the hand of the family right through. So things are changing,
and so there are different things in place. I'm going to read out a couple of reactions from our listeners, because people have been getting in touch with the programme and did off the back of the interviews. Someone said, I just wanted to say how much these interviews resonated deeply with me. I found myself in this position some time ago, and I'm still recovering from the absolute devastation it caused in my life and for my family. I try hard to stay and support my partner, but ultimately left as it was making me ill. goes to what you were saying there, Rachel. I now think there's a very definite before and after. I'm a completely different person following this awful period in my life. I will probably never forgive my ex-partner and remain as angry now as I was in the immediate aftermath. I would like to remain anonymous, as there are still people in my life who don't know exactly why we divorced. All I ever say is that it was a huge betrayal of trust and immense hurt, and I couldn't forgive. I mean, these are very, very powerful emotional messages we've had. But, you know, Deborah, actually we heard from Evie, the second interview, where she talked about supporting her brother. And somebody's messaging to say, thank you, Evie, for being so brave and honest. This is still a taboo subject which tears so many families apart. Social services need to help these families too. I worked as a social worker for many years. The offences do not always completely define the offender. What do you think about that? Because she's, you know, it's obvious. Do you find that people do support their families? Is there a right way, a wrong way? What should people do?
Well, first off, there absolutely isn't ever any right way or wrong way. And everyone's situation is different, and everyone's relationship with the person who's committed the harm will be different. What we hear from families, wives, partners, parents, brothers, sisters, all the people around, is that any direction they look and any decision they have to make, there is not a good outcome. If you leave, there are bad outcomes. If you stay, there are bad outcomes. There is no good decision making to be done. So what we try to do as an organisation is help people think that through. And we don't make judgments. And I would urge everybody not to judge somebody for their actions. Evie was very clear. She had her own reasons for wanting to support her brother. Everyone will have their own reasons for the decision they make. And no decision would be a bad decision if it's right for them. That's the first thing. What we do see, particularly with our wives, is about a 50-50 split. So half will stay and half will leave. What I want to make clear, really, though, is once that decision has been made, it's not a final decision. So as described your message just then, she attempted to stay. It didn't work out. She felt she had to leave. So things change as well, and situations move on, and trauma is not static. So that will evolve over time. What we will stress, though, is that no family member or wife should feel responsible for policing the behaviour of their loved one. If they choose to support them, as Evie described, to reduce loneliness, to help with depression, to try and keep him safe, that's admirable, but it's not the relative's job to do that. So they shouldn't feel responsible for their loved one's behaviour. Giving support is one thing, but feeling responsible would be a different thing.
We did actually get another reaction to Evie's email interview that says the woman talking about her brother who was convicted of sexual offences, she should be congratulated on such a mature, empathetic, wise and compassionate response to her current situation. To think of the potential future victims of sexual abuse by supporting her brother is to be hugely congratulated. I can't imagine how hard her situation is. All love and power to her. Sending a massive hug. Her children are so lucky to have such a wonderful mother.
I really hope she heard that.
I hope so too. And very quickly, because we've run out of time on this, to both of you, if there is someone listening who is struggling to deal with a family member who has been accused or found guilty of a sexual against the child, and the chances are there will be, what advice would you give them, Rachel?
So I'd say you don't need to be going through it alone. You mentioned in the text there about the secrecy, and Evie was the same, not telling anybody. Yeah. And that's really common, the isolation. So you don't need to go through it alone. As Deborah said, Lucy Faithful online forum, there's Talking Forward, which is a peer support group people can come to. And, you know, they just don't need to feel alone
anymore. And we'll put some links up on our website. And Deborah, from you very quickly, what do you want to see change? What needs to be in place?
Goodness, so much actually, but really quickly, this perception of the families and the society stigma. If I could change one thing, it would be that, because that is what prohibits women from really coming forward. And it's also what holds back our agencies who are working with the families do better in how they treat them, how they behave with them. Some Evie described children's services. We are working hard to increase the support for families. But I think if I could change one thing, it would be the potential perceptions of non-offending family members and making it okay to talk about these issues.
So less societal judgment. Thank you both very much for speaking to me about that, Deborah Dennis and Rachel Armitage. And just for anybody who is listening who does want to reach out, the links to some of the charities that were spoken about there are on our website. So please head to the Women's Hour website. Thank you both.